are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, September 12th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, investigative journalist David Dayan on the resistance inside the Obama administration. Also on the program today, the Republicans in a panic as Mitch McConnell tries to ram Judge Kavanaugh and other federal judges down our collective throats. As Florence steams toward the Carolinas, it's revealed Trump administration took $10 million from the FEMA budget for ICE. Meanwhile, the Saudis and the UAE get a congressional certification that they don't mean to kill civilians. Paul Manafort eyeing a deal in anticipation of his next trial. Meanwhile, FEMA has ignored over 2,300 post-Hurricane Maria funeral assistance requests in Puerto Rico. Why should they? As far as they're concerned, there wasn't 3,000 deaths there. The national prison strike ends. Meanwhile, in South Carolina, officials refuse to evacuate inmates in the path of Hurricane Florence. And a report, 75% of dark money in federal elections comes from just 15 groups over the past 10 years. And meet your new Scarelli, a 70-year-old antibiotics quadrupled in price because morality. And Trump's Office of Civil Rights, the DOJ, offers a new definition of anti-Semitism for college campuses: no criticizing Israel. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, we will get to many of these stories and more today on the program. I am back. It is a new year now. Is the days of awe, as we call it, in the Jewish religion, where you reflect back on how you really screwed up over the past year. And then you have a day of atonement, and that'll come in 9 days. So I will be out next Wednesday. And then you just start all over again. You screw up again for the rest of the year. It's the way it works.
It's cool to have two New Years a year to do that.
It's not two New Years, technically. Like, Rosh Hashanah was a New Year. And one would think that you'd want to get rid of your sins before the New Year, right? You wouldn't want to taint the New Year. So the last couple of days of the old year is where you get rid of the sins. But they do it the other way for the Jews. So I guess the idea is that, like, it's really you focus on this year. And not last year. And no, Elijah does not come. That's Passover.
I'm aware of that now. I've made a mistake on my podcast over the weekend. But also, your sins don't go away in Judaism, right? You just have to feel
they don't
bad
go away. They don't
and
go
resolve
away.
To do better.
No, you are they don't go away, but you make an effort to just try and do better. That's all.
It's all we can ever do, really.
Folks, speaking of doing better, I am constantly looking for new ways in which to aggregate my news because, as you know, I'm literally a professional newsreader. It's what I do for a profession. And there's a new site, has an app as well, newsvoice.com/majority. They are sponsoring the program. Look, it's difficult to get a grip on a lot of different stories. One of the techniques that I've always done is I get a story, and in fact, you can see it almost here in my packet. The way I do this is I have a topic, and then I'll read multiple stories about that topic. And because sometimes I'll get one fact from one story, they don't get from another fact story, or you want different perspectives, right? Now, for me, when I read a more conservative leaning perspective on things, I'm looking to see how they're going to lie about it. Now, you may be a little bit less jaded than I am, and you may just perceive it as getting more informed about it. But either way, News Voice has come up with a response to the problems of having a limited perspective. It's a website and app for iOS and Android. It gives you access for free if you go to newsvoice.com/majority. And you get a personalized news feed by aggregating a mix of mainstream media sources, international sources, and independent media sources. Multiple sources are provided for each news story. So you can get a story, and then you can get multiple sources on it that give you a great perspective. The whole site is fueled by crowdsourcing. You can upvote stories you think are important so more people will see them. You can add stories to the site. You can add a source that's missing for a story. I'm not going to try and put my thumb on any scales here, but go over there, join, and start kicking up the Majority Report. It's meant to be completely open and democratized source for news that lets you get every side of every story. They also have a video interview series featuring guests from Chris Hedges to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Go download the app for free by going to newsvoice.com/majority. I've put a link under the video if you're watching on YouTube. It is newsvoice.com/majority. Also, if you like the stories you hear on this show and you're interested in stories that have to do with conservation and the environment, check out Sierra Club's new storytelling podcast, The Land I Trust. Season 2 of The Land I Trust is out now. It brings you storytellers from across the Western U.S. who share their experiences in harvesting, protecting, living with the four natural elements, water, fire, wind, and air. The series has 14 tales of individuals across the Western part of the country as they share their tales of climate change, clean energy, everything in between. Each year, the Sierra Club visits a different region of the country for a new set of stories. Season 1 was from the American South. Talk to musicians, families, farmers, and climate refugees helping to move the South from coal ash pollution to a brighter, cleaner future. You can listen to The Land I Trust at beyondcoal.org/stories. It's beyondcoal.org/stories or on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever you get your podcasts. Check out Season 2 of The Land I Trust today. And lastly, I always like reading an ad from The New Yorker because, as you know, The New Yorker, it's an iconic magazine. It represents the best writing in America today. Beyond publishing the best writers in the country, New Yorker holds people in power accountable through rigorous reporting, compelling storytelling. They write beautiful pieces on subjects readers may not have previously put much thought into, like the world's diminishing supply of sand or heirloom beans. They have features like poetry, fiction, cultural criticism, satire in every issue. Get the best writing anywhere, everywhere with home delivery or of the print edition each week, or you can read on the go with the New Yorker Today app or via Google News. For instance, next week on this program, we're going to have a guy named Tews. What's his first name? Adam? So this guy, Adam Tews, has written a book that sounds fascinating to me. First, I heard about it in the New Yorker magazine. John Cassidy wrote a review of it. And I was like, oh, this book sounds like a book that we should have on the Majority Report. It's Crashed, How a Decade of Financial Crises Changed the World. Coincidentally, Dan mentioned it in the piece that we're going to have him on today, too, for. So New Yorker's great in that way. There's another good piece that about John Bolton's net, like, what do they call it? 2.0 attack on the International Criminal Court explains what he's on about. The New Yorker gives me the super solid reporting stories you just don't see anywhere else. Now, look, you can go and get an incredible deal on the New Yorker. Go to newyorker.com/majority. Listeners of the Majority Report save 50% when they enter the code MAJORITY. So check this out. You're going to get 12 issues for just $6. Plus, you get the exclusive New Yorker tote bag. You can choose between print, digital, or a combo subscription. Subscribe to the New Yorker. Read something that means something. That's 12 issues for $6 and a free tote bag when you go to newyorker.com/majority. All right, let's check out. This is Donald Trump. We are, I guess, 2 days now out from landfall of Florence. We're in hurricane season. There's multiple hurricanes brewing in the Atlantic. You know, you're starting to read. It seems like this happens every year, and with good reason, because each year, it seems, brings another level of unprecedented hurricanes. And this is really, I was talking about this with Saul, if you can believe it, the other day, explaining to him fog. And, you know, he has these books that explain how the water cycle works, right? The water's on the ground, it heats up, it evaporates, it goes up into the clouds, it cools down, it rains, and it just keeps going around like this. And apparently what happens now with the hurricanes is because the oceans have begun to warm, there's more evaporation, it just creates an accelerant, and you've got these hurricanes that are coming off the water with a lot more water and a lot more intensity. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is dealing with the fact that this that recently the state, or I shouldn't say the state, the government of Puerto Rico has announced that the official death tally in the wake of Hurricane Maria is 3,000 people. Some people are suggesting that it's actually as high as 4,100, 4,200. Donald Trump still wants to, in many respects, deny that. We see FEMA denying almost over 2,000 post-Maria funeral requests in terms of assistance from Puerto Rican citizens because they can't concede what the real number of deaths are. Here is Donald Trump having some type of, I don't know, meltdown. I mean, if Donald Trump was a robot, you would go in and say there's something wrong with the circuitry, talking about Hurricane Maria and the lack of response from the Trump administration.
Puerto Rico was incredibly successful. Puerto Rico was actually our toughest one of all because it's an island, so you can't truck things onto it. Everything's by boat. We moved a hospital into Puerto Rico, a tremendous military hospital in the form of a ship, you know that. And I actually think, and the governor has been very nice, and if you ask the governor, he'll tell you what a great job. I think probably the hardest one we had by far was Puerto Rico because of the island nature. And I actually think it was one of the best jobs that's ever been done with respect to what this is all about. Puerto Rico got hit not with one hurricane, but with two. And the problem with Puerto Rico is their electric grid and their electric generating plant was dead before the storms ever hit.
Pause it. That's not true. They weren't in great shape, but they were actually fully functional. And the vast majority, I don't want to say 100% of people had power on the island, but it was probably in the deep into the 90s.
Better than the 11 months.
Right. As opposed to the 11 months where like 75 to 90% of the people did not have power. But go ahead.
It was in very bad shape. It was in bankruptcy, had no money. It was largely, you know, it was largely closed. And when the storm hit, they had no electricity, essentially before the storm. And when the storm hit, that took it out entirely.
Pause it. They had electricity before the storm. Not essentially no electricity. Not only not essentially no electricity, no electricity. They had electricity.
Before the storm, and when the storm hit, that took it out entirely. The job that FEMA and law enforcement and everybody did working along with the governor in Puerto Rico, I think, was tremendous. I think that Puerto Rico was an incredible, unsung success.
There's more of that, right? Isn't there more in that? Like, he just keeps going on. Like, we had two others, but Puerto Rico is an island. I mean, the guy is having a complete meltdown over this. And, like, he does everything, though. But the bottom line is, there is a huge portion of this country that all they need is that, and then they can just move forward and ignore this stuff. You know, 17 years out, we talk about the 3,000 people who died in 9/11. The 3,000 people who died as a function of the just incredibly slow response by our own government to a natural disaster. Not so much. Folks can move on. It's just like there's a huge portion of this country that just needs, doesn't even have to be a good lie.
Was that you that talked to the guy who was really impressed by the mother of all bombs dropping?
Yes.
Like what Trump said about the military, the ship hospital being anchored into Puerto Rico, that's like that sort of thing, right? They just need a little trinket or something.
The only thing it reminds me of is, I think I've told the story, I directed I'm with Busey. And on day one, when I first met him, he would not shoot in an area that we were in like, I think it was Taos. And they have these vortexes around. And he's like, I don't want to shoot at this wrong place. And we're in this field. And I went out there, and the first thing I said to him, I said, did they not tell you why we're shooting here? No, why? Because this is the only place within 300 miles where you can grow organic garlic, because they say because of the vortexes. I don't know if I buy that, but that's what they say. And he's just like, we're shooting here. Like, I totally made it up, but it was just like, there's a reason. Oh, okay, good. All right, great. We're shooting here. And that's basically what's happening out with the rest of the country. Oh, yeah, no, it's the best ever. That's what's going to be different when the Democrats, if they take over the House, there's actually going to be pushback and investigations on all of this. You can bet there's going to be investigations about the response to Hurricane Maria. You can bet. There should be.
Yeah, because Democrats are so good at holding Republicans accountable for things that they did.
I mean, the Democrats are pretty good in terms of at least doing the investigations. And in the context of agencies, you know, as much as I completely have, for almost two decades now, maybe more, criticized Bill Clinton, FEMA was one of the things that he did well.
You're right. They are good with data, provided that the Trump administration doesn't destroy the data before they get in there.
I think these investigations are going to be good. What they do with them, that's another question. But at the very least, there's going to be an understanding of what went wrong. I think some agencies will improve, but that is what I think the Trump administration, not just the Trump administration, the heads of these, the Republican heads of these agencies are also concerned about. Folks, we're going to take a quick break. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can become a member today by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you do, we say thank you by giving you the show commercial free. We cut out all commercials. And then what we also do is give you extra content every day. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Quick break, right back with David Dan. We are back, ladies and gentlemen. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. It is always a pleasure to welcome to the program the hardest working man in journalism, but it's not just that, because, you know, this is not there's so much more to this man's talent than just his hard working. And I don't even know if he sleeps. You may have read his writing in just about every publication that you've ever read. But David Dayen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Samuel.
David, let's talk about your most recent piece. This was not in The Intercept, although you had a recent piece in The Intercept, multiple pieces, not in any of the other the 50 other publications you write for. You wrote a piece in The New Republic in response to, or at least I guess this is maybe a partial reminder, the op-ed that is supposedly from a high-level White House official talking right. about how they're usurping Donald Trump in office. Well, let's leave that aside for a moment anyways. But you took the occasion to retell the story of Tim Geithner. And, of course, this is the week that Lehman Brothers crashed, right? 10 years ago? Are we in the
10 years ago on Saturday.
Wow, there you go. And so tell us that story. This is, and for folks who are younger, don't remember, it started like I guess it would have been in August, right, that Bear Stearns shuttered just immediately?
That was actually March.
Oh, was it in March?
2008.
Oh, jeez. So, okay.
I mean, the housing bubble started to, you know, collapse under its own weight at the end of 2006. And this thing kind of in a very protracted way led to a cascade of different closures and things of that nature, whether it was New Century Financial and AmeriQuest, which were mortgage originators, some hedge funds from Bear Stearns that closed up in 2007. And then this started to infect the balance sheets of these large investment banks, which had a lot of mortgage-backed securities on their books, as well as derivatives that were sort of one step removed, but were based on the prices of mortgages. You know, you had Bear Stearns collapse, and then Lehman was sort of the next big one. Bear Stearns was purchased by J.P. Morgan at a fire sale rate, and Lehman was seeking a buyer, and eventually it was allowed to go bankrupt. And this really was the emblematic event of the financial crisis, because it showed that there was the potential for, you know, the lack of a rescue, a sort of unstructured bankruptcy, and this led to a lot of things in the credit system that really seized up the broader financial system and led to the bailout.
So now, cut to the first quarter of 2009. Obama's now
right.
president.
And things are still going badly.
Right.
Right. I mean, that's the thing we have to explain. So the banks are certainly not in a healthy situation. We are losing on the order of 700,000 to 800,000 jobs a month. New policies have yet to really be put in place and take effect. And across Obama's economic team, there are varying viewpoints as to what to do, particularly about now it's coming to the commercial banks, the big mega banks like Bank of America and Citigroup in particular. These banks have lost billions of dollars in the fourth quarter of 2008. Their stocks are being punished. Citigroup stock in the first quarter of 2009 was as low as 97 cents. It was like a penny stock. And this is a huge global bank. There are these serious conversations being had over, you know, possibly to nationalize these large banks, which we did see elsewhere in the world, in England and other places. So, and in the previous decade, Sweden used this to nationalize its banks during a financial crisis to decent results. So
let me just give folks just a metaphor so they can understand sort of like how this happens. It's like as if like you have a small particle, you know, in your fuel, and it goes in and starts causing different problems as it works its way through the system. Right. And it compounds other problems. So at first it starts off as a speck, and this is. And then it just as it goes through the system, the problem becomes more and more problematic. So by the time we're in March of 2009, it takes that long to realize just how bad the situation is for some of these banks. And part of it is also because they were on a mission to sort of hide how bad things were because everybody's, you know, covering their ass at that point.
That's number one. And number two is the fact that these balance sheets were so interconnected. The financial system is you know, incredibly linked to one another. So a problem, or at least it was at that time. So a problem in one aspect of the system just sort of flows through and affects everybody else. And Citigroup had a tremendous amount of liabilities on its balance sheet. We had already been through two different bailouts of Citigroup. One, the TARP bailout, which was $25 billion of capital that was supplied to them. That wasn't enough. In November of 2008, there was a second $20 billion bailout, and that wasn't taking either.
Okay, wait, so now explain something to us, David. So we've given them $45 billion, all right?
Right.
And I understand the metaphor. It's like it's a bucket. And you can't see the bottom of the bucket, and it just ends up having no bottom, and it just goes down to this sort of black pit. But what do they do with that money? Like, we give them $45 billion. Who gets right. that money, and why does it have no impact?
Well, it's a capital infusion, and what it's meant to do is to shore up the day-to-day operations liabilities that it has to pay out, the write-downs that the bank has to take on its losses. It's supposed to absorb all that. And as you say, it's like catching a falling knife. The losses were just mounting on the balance sheet, and there was no way to really use, you know, that money was limited in the functions it could do to actually, offset these tremendous losses that were going on. And so there were a lot of things talked about what to do with Citigroup. One was to sort of shield off their worst assets, put them in what is called a bad bank, and try to have the rest of the bank go forward with its so-called good assets, and just sort of ring fence those bad assets and put them in a separate unit. That ended up actually happening. The other option was essentially to break up Citigroup. And Larry Summers actually argued for this option. Sheila Bair was consulted about this option. There was a meeting in March of 2009, March 15th, where the economic team was talking about these different ways in which they could either completely nationalize, which would be take Citigroup and put it on the government, at least for a period of time, or to break it up into parts and sell those parts off. And what the upshot of that meeting on March 15, 2009, according to Ron Suskind, who wrote this book, Confidence Men, he said that the idea was to cleave off the worst assets, wipe out the shareholders, and downsize and restructure the rest of the firm. And Obama
All right, but now wait. Before we get to that part of it, I just want people to really understand these different options. If we were to nationalize the bank, what would that mean in practice? Like, how would that stop if I understand it, it wouldn't do anything other than saying, if we're going to spend tax dollars on this, right? If we're just going to keep shoveling money into this system, regardless of whether we break it up or not, or whatever we do, it's just that if we're going to keep paying for this, we want to own it. And
The other part of it is the financial system is in some respects based on confidence. The idea that investors and depositors believe that the money that they put into the system will be able to come back out. And so when you put the full faith and credit of the United States behind it, you tend to raise that confidence level rather than relying on Citigroup, which has proven itself a failure and has this tremendous amount of liabilities on its balance sheet. So that was part of it as well.
Okay. And so, and then there's this option of, and then, so it's a combination of one, you will lend the confidence that the United States government represents to the bank. Two, you will not be spending tax dollars and getting nothing in return. The other options are basically like, if I had a small bodega and I had sadly made the mistake of investing in all sorts of products that I'm going to stock on my shelves that nobody wants, like, you know, I don't know, First Sinks or whatever it is. But my lottery sales business is doing okay. So you cleave those two apart. And, you know, if my father-in-law had given me all this money to buy the First Sinks, and he was like, this is a great idea. You just store the First Sinks there. People come and buy it. He's the one who's just not going to get repaid. And the lottery part of the business is just going to go on, is basically it.
Yeah, that's a decent enough analogy. So so this was put out there. And you know, Obama was on the record at this point saying, we can't do Sweden, we can't do nationalization. He used some kind of spurious reasons to say so. But he signed off on this idea that we were going to come up with a resolution for Citigroup. And he wrote an order to the Treasury Department, this is all according to Susskind's book, that the Treasury Department needed to prepare, you know, hash out the details of how this would actually work. He wasn't saying to the Treasury, you know, execute the resolution of Citigroup. He was saying, you need to prepare for it. And write me a plan, an outline of how this would look in practice. And Citigroup, the Treasury Department, which was led by Timothy Geithner at that point, didn't do this. They simply didn't follow this request. They didn't produce any proposal for the wind down of Citigroup. They just waited and waited, and they, you know, instead Treasury continued with the strategy that they had in the first place, which was continuing to protect the banks at all costs. That was Geithner's worldview. That was his plan. He executed this through a third bailout of Citigroup. He shot the money cannon at Citi with Federal Reserve loans and guarantees, he continued the stress tests, which were designed to kind of promote this confidence among the markets by saying that we have now run the numbers, and in an adverse scenario, this bank will need X amount of dollars in capital in order to survive. And while initially the number that they generated for the first stress test for Citigroup was something like $35 billion, there was essentially a negotiation session between Citigroup and the government that got that number down to just $5 billion. And when that number came up as so small, the investor class was reassured that, okay, well, Citigroup doesn't need that much money. Their balance sheet must be healthy, and so we'll continue to invest in Citigroup. And all of those things cumulatively kind of nursed Citigroup back to health, rendering the need for this proposal that Obama asked for less relevant. And so, you know, Tim Geithner resisted the direct presidential order, did his own thing, and moved forward. And how is that exactly any different than what this unnamed official is saying they're doing with respect to the Trump administration?
The only difference is that the unnamed official has admitted they're doing it. And Geithner probably would say, like, no, we just couldn't get them. I kept saying, do it. I mean,
Indeed, Geithner did deny that this happened. He said, I don't slow walk the president on anything. But of course, you know, Susskind asked Obama about this. And he said, you know, I think the quote is, the speed with which the bureaucracy could exercise my decision was slower than I wanted.
Right.
So read between the lines. It happened. I don't think Obama was particularly upset about it because it worked out, and he wasn't exactly a radical on bank retribution or anything. But, you know, it's pretty clear to me that this is the way that this went down.
And we should also be clear that there, you know, this is not necessarily a no harm, no foul type of situation. I mean, this would have to get rid of or to break apart one of the biggest systemic risks we have that comes in the form of Citibank. I mean, and this is a conversation, you know, in 10 years, maybe 5 years. You and I will revisit and we'll say, yeah, it's too bad they didn't break up Citibank at that time because of this next financial crisis that comes along.
Yeah.
But
I would say a couple things about it. Number one, you know, the way in which Geithner saved the system and preserved the system rather than overhauling it made it easier for today, the Trump administration, to effectively dismantle the rules and safeguards and tweaks to the current system. You know, they've completely weakened and softened the stress tests, which were kind of the top thing Geithner was using to promote market confidence. Larry Summers came out a few days ago and called them comically absurd. And we continue to see rampant abuse of consumers, whether you're talking about Wells Fargo or whoever, with very little enforcement being done because the Trump administration has kind of called off the guards. So when you preserve that system, all of the potential abuses and breakdowns of that system can return, and now they've returned within 10 years rather than, you know, after the Depression, we had the New Deal reforms that lasted about 50 years. So that's number one. Number two is the political implications of throwing money at any major institution in the financial world and not doing the same for homeowners. The implications were a slower economic recovery. The implication was mass political anger and frustration at the two-tiered system where banks got bailed out and everybody else got left out. And this leads to the rise of populism and the presidency that we have today, I would argue. So this was not costless.
And taking the second one first and then the first one second, I am increasingly feeling that, like, the one of the untold stories of the of Trump's ascendancy is not so much that people turned to Trump as much as they just didn't show up because they were just, like, you know, just disgusted by the whole system on some level. And mm-hmm. that it was demoralizing for people to see this, to hear stories of, like, hey, $45 billion just dumped into this, you know, this black hole of Citibank without even sort of questioning it. And these stress tests, which are, you know, tend to remind me of, like, it's almost like saying they have a triple A rating, right? From a Moody's or something like that. These banks are fine. And I think that's that became a huge sense of disillusionment for people. I don't know if they could get so granular with it as much as just sort of this overriding sense of like there's no accountability, that everything that to the extent that anybody's going to suffer, it's not going to be those institutions that actually were directly involved in this mess, but rather people who are downstream from it. And just in terms of the first thing, it seems to me that much of the legislative achievements of the Obama administration, and, you know, people can debate as to how significant they were, you know, in a vacuum, right? Whether it's Dodd-Frank or whether it was like the ACA, the lesson of the Trump administration relative to those achievements have been, if you don't take a meat cleaver to a problem and fundamentally redesign the system that led to that problem, any sort of add-ons, you know, any type of like narrow fixes that you offer for that system, right? So like the ACA in terms of private insurance and all of these, like, all built on a series of regulatory fixes about the markets and this and that, and the same with Dodd-Frank, all like sort of small bore. All we need are these 23 different small elements that will create this reform. The lesson, it seems to be, is that that can get unwound super easy, easily. Like, that is not durable solution at all. To create that type of like regulatory structure on a major problem.
Right. Whereas if you had a size cap on the largest banks, which is something that was proposed during Dodd-Frank and ultimately got a vote but failed, even if the Trump administration sought to reverse that size cap or give allowances to that size cap, you know, the banks have already been downsized, right? So it's going to take some time to rebuild that asset allocation. So you know, there's a big difference between an overhaul, which, you know, has to get reconstituted in some way, even if the laws change, and a technocratic kind of tweak to the system, and which can get unraveled very rapidly and has been. So, yes.
Well, and you have a quote from Adam Tooze from his new book, Crashed, and we're going to speak to him, I think it's next week.
It's a remarkable book, and I highly recommend it.
You quote him as writing, we do not need to imagine that he, speaking of Geithner, was in the pocket of any one bank. It was his commitment to the system that dictated this, that Citigroup should not be broken up. Like, that to me is a is the story of the Obama administration in many respects. And
Right. It
also sort of explains, you know, you don't, it's not a quid pro quo when somebody goes and gets paid by a bank to speak in front of them or gets hired after they leave the administration. It's because they are of that ilk, and
you hire
in that way.
They're marinated in that worldview. I mean, Geithner gets so bent out of shape when people say that he worked for a bank when he actually was, he claims to have been a public servant. Now, the New York Federal Reserve is a bank. It's a bank of banks, actually. But and he was the head of that. But the point is that that wasn't the issue. The issue was that he knew all the same people. He talked to all the same people. And the people that wanted him to move in a particular direction, in this case, protecting the system, knew that those were the steps that he was going to take at any cost. And we don't talk as much about cultural capture as we do about, you know, regulatory capture or the revolving door or whatever else. But cultural capture, I think, really is the defining characteristic, particularly of the financial rescue and how it was undertaken.
It continues to be such a fascinating story and having such resonance. We're 10 years out from it now, and I'm convinced that, you know, the stuff that went down during those first couple of years in particular continue to dictate our politics. We see it. You wrote about in The Intercept about Sean Patrick Maloney and his race with Zephyr Teachout, and of course Tish James also for the AG in New York State. But this is a guy who voted I don't know how many there were, maybe two or three dozen Democrats in the House who voted to basically strip down Dodd-Frank. And it's a perfect example of what happens when you don't have a structural reform, but rather you do it sort of like regulatory wise when, you know, that it's like putting, I don't know, tape on a wound as opposed to sort of like fundamentally sewing it up and doing something structural.
Yeah, definitely. And that's what made the rollback so simple. It was really, I mean, the largest part of that rollback is really just a change of digits. It changed the threshold for enhanced regulatory supervision from banks with $50 billion in assets to banks with $250 billion in assets. That's literally just adding a two. And in doing that, you have let 25 of the 38 largest banks off the hook for a host of different types of scrutiny that was put in specifically because banks that are larger and more connected to other parts of the financial system have the propensity for greater overall systemic risk. Now, Maloney, when he talked about this was at a debate last week, talking and responding to Teachout's charge that he did this, said that he did it on behalf of the African-American small bankers in his district. Which is, you know, absurd considering that the lead critical piece of this rollback is this giveaway to these large banks, what I call the stadium banks, banks that aren't, you know, the top 10 biggest banks in America, but are big enough that they can buy the naming rights to a stadium. And it's really even more absurd that he's hiding sort of behind African-American small bankers when another key element of the Dodd-Frank rollback that passed earlier this year is limiting the disclosure that mortgage companies have to give to that help prosecutors detect lending discrimination. So it's literally an assault on the ability to figure out if people of color are being discriminated against with higher mortgage rates. And he's hiding behind this idea that black bankers somehow asked for this change. It's completely absurd.
All right, let's talk about one more absurd thing. Since we are now in, you know, past Labor Day, the congressional and Senate races become more significant. We're seeing a lot of evidence that the Republicans are, at the very least, Republican elected leaders are fairly convinced they're going to lose the House, right? And I contend that Mitch McConnell's fairly convinced that there's at least a significant enough risk that he's going to lose the Senate that they need to get every judge passed that they can in the next, like, whatever it is, 4 weeks.
Yeah, he's even going to keep them in October, which never happens in the election year.
Now, all right, just the spin that I saw about this was that supposedly this was to screw over Democrats. But it seems to me that there's not going to be, there's nobody in Joe Manchin's district, you know, in the state of West Virginia who's going to go like, Joe Manchin's not there to vote against Mitch McConnell's judicial picks. He's here right. campaigning. Well, I'm not going to vote for him. Like, who's going to say that? It seems to me that Mitch McConnell is just basically pretending that he's not afraid that the Democrats are going to take over the Senate. And so instead of saying we're holding session in October so that I can squeeze every little bit out of this moment that I know is going away or I think might go away, I'm going to make it seem like I'm just screwing over the Democrats.
I think what he's trying to do is bluff Chuck Schumer. So Chuck Schumer, a couple weeks ago, relented and allowed the fast tracking of 15 judges without so much as even a voice vote, so that members of the Democratic Senate caucus who needed the campaign could go home around Labor Day.
But they could have gone home. They could have gone home
they
whenever.
Could they could have anyway.
They just would have missed
but
the
there
votes
is an
against judges
I mean,
that they were going to let through anyways.
That's right. And they don't even have to be there to vote. I mean, a no-show is as good as a vote when you're talking about the situation. The affirmative votes, people like Dean Heller and Ted Cruz, who also want to go home to campaign,
they
those
have
are
to be
necessary.
There. Yes.
Because if you don't have those, you don't get to the threshold that you need to get to.
But let me be generous. Let me be generous, though, and just say that it's conceivable, although I like I say, it seems ridiculous that Joe Manchin's opponent or Heidi Heitkamp's opponent could say, like, look at you. You're not even there to vote.
The no-show. Yeah, well, I mean, that's a classic of the genre, right? I mean, you hear that sort of every 2 years. There's no real indication that voters look at attendance records when they go to the polls and think about who to vote for.
Well, it also is a little bit off message.
Particularly attendance records in the last month of the session when their lawmakers are in front of them campaigning in their district.
Right. I mean, it seems a little bit odd for a Republican challenger to bring up, like, you're not in Washington enough. I mean, right?
Yeah. But here's the point. Chuck Schumer, with a small handful of off-cycle Senate Democrats, could force deliberate and slow passage of these judicial confirmations. All they have to do is object to the unanimous consent ruling, because everything in the Senate operates by unanimous consent.
And then you need
all
30
they have to
hours.
Do is they need one person sitting there reading the paper. And objecting, one Democrat, you know, on a rotating basis, objecting to every unanimous consent request. And yes, then they have 30 hours of debate time they have to go through for every single judge. And you can spread that out. And if Mitch McConnell wants to do that, there are two 30-hour blocks of time that he would have to go through. If he really wants to get those judges confirmed, he could get as few in that month of October confirmed as, I think, 6 or 7 judges, while holding up his two members that are threatened, Ted Cruz and Dean Heller, who would have to be there to vote eventually.
All right, David.
So if he wants to do that, go ahead.
But,
let him.
But, David, why is it that, okay, and why is Chuck Schumer not doing this? I mean, you are talking to people, you are reporting. I sit here in my seat and I just say Chuck Schumer is just sort of either, intellectually challenged so significantly that he can't see this, or there's some other thing that I can't even understand. Like maybe he's, you know, golf buddies with Mitch McConnell and they had some bet about this or something. I mean, like, why is this so difficult for Chuck Schumer to grasp? Like, what is the fear here?
It's honestly baffling. I've written about this. I've talked to people about this. It does seem that Schumer, who, remember, this is his first term as a Senate caucus leader, whether in minority or majority, And he was, you know, unprepared for the tactics that he would have to take to slow down the rush of judges. By the way, the Senate has really just become a judicial confirmation factory,
right,
since the passage of
the tax law.
More judges have been confirmed that have been nominated by Trump than any president of the last several decades. We're talking about over, I think, 68 judges now have been put to lifetime appointments on the federal bench, with more to come.
There one in, are one in like seven.
20 or
one
there's
in
something
seven.
Like 20 or 30 in the pipeline.
Yep.
That could be done in the next months and the lame duck session and beyond if Republicans hold the Senate. So it's just not being made a priority to at least slow this down. Nobody's saying, because of the way the rules are, that every judge could be stopped, but they certainly don't have to be fast tracked with 15 judges passed in the last 2 weeks. That didn't have to happen. It's not necessarily the case that 15 judges, if you use the dilatory tactics, the slow down tactics, it's not clear that 15 could have been done between now and the end of the year. They were done in 2 weeks, and there are more behind them.
So is this it's just incompetence?
It's not taking it seriously.
Is it just incompetence? I mean, I don't understand.
I mean,
like,
maybe
organizations who are knocking on Schumer's door and going, like, dude, this is important. They're on the,
right.
You know, like, isn't there not,
you know,
a senator?
I'm sure Schumer would tell you he's getting other executive branch nominations. There was a National Labor Relations Board guy who was reappointed or renominated, I guess. He might tell you that that we're doing this so that we can get a better budget. You know, there are any number of sort of alibis that I suppose you can make.
He told me he was going to be okay with DACA. He really loves children, he said.
Right. I mean, the bottom line is that this is no joke. This is the number one priority of the conservative movement, and has been for the last year, and is not being met with the same kind of prioritization, attention, and seriousness from the minority leader of the Senate.
Well, David, always a pleasure talking to you. Always a pleasure.
Good talking to you.
All right. Well, thanks, man. Maybe Chuck Schumer will get the message. I don't remember when a Senate minority or majority leader has gotten voted out. Do you remember one? Has there been one of those? I mean, you know what happens in the House with some frequency, but I don't remember anybody in the Senate losing their leadership job. He already left. All right. Yeah, there you go. All right, David Dayan. Let that be a rhetorical question, folks. For David Dayan, I'll ask him later. I mean, there it is. Very frustrating. I don't know what else to say. I mean, I've spent an inordinate amount of time screaming at Chuck Schumer's residence over the past 2 years.
Yeah, it's
like literally
by Prospect Park there.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
At Grand Army Plaza, there's been at least one or two protests. And,
yeah, it's almost like it's not his first priority to advance progressive goals.
It's almost like he's just incredibly incompetent. I mean, there's no, you know, it's just, and the failure of the left, like, I mean, if anybody could point me to, but for a couple of people we've had on this program, any organization that's out there saying that Chuck Schumer is failing on these federal judiciary. I mean, we've had this argument before. The problem is that there's no grassroots pressure on this guy about this stuff. I mean, he could be super competent, and it would be great if we had political leaders who didn't need any pressure in terms of dictating their priorities. But this is not like the conversation we just had with David is sort of ubiquitous everywhere, and you can hear it. It rarely comes up in any context. But I don't know, folks in New York at least have an opportunity tomorrow, not necessarily to vote against Chuck Schumer, but tomorrow to vote for Zephyr Teachout, who I really do think could change the nature of. I think, I mean, as much as I want Andrew Cuomo to go away, and I would encourage everybody to vote for Cynthia Nixon tomorrow if you hear the sound of my voice and you have the ability to vote in the New York primary. But I think Zephyr Teachout, if she becomes attorney general, will be one of the most consequential Democratic primary results, because she will go on to be attorney general in New York State.
I mean, she wrote the book on corruption.
She literally wrote the book on corruption. And I think Andrew Cuomo will be very concerned if Zephyr Teachout becomes the AG. And I think a lot of the bankers will be concerned if she becomes the AG. I think Donald Trump will be very concerned. I think corporations around the country will be very concerned, because New York doesn't quite have the power that California does in terms of the size of their economy. But California dictates to the auto industry what their CAFE standards are going to be because of the size of their market. New York State has that ability in other products. What are you asking me? How do I?
I don't understand
why the Times endorses Cuomo and Teachout? Well, I mean, I think from the perspective of the Times, it doesn't surprise me. I mean, Teachout's win would be a big win for good government and for things like antitrust and whatnot. I think there is a sense among Democrats that, like, look, you know, we've had Cuomo for two terms, and we're still standing. So he's not that much of a disaster. There's no incumbent that Teachout's running against. So I think from the Times perspective, and I also think that they probably don't perceive Nixon as having that much of a chance. So why go out on a limb from an endorsement?
Well, why should a newspaper care about that? Like, they're not a union, you know? Like, what power does Cuomo have to get back at them?
Well, I'm not sure that they're concerned about that as much as they probably want to maintain their status. I mean, nobody, you know, I'm not justifying it. I'm just saying that, like, you know, if you're a newspaper that wants to pretend that your endorsement means something, you don't want to endorse people that you know are going to lose, or it's going to make it look like your endorsement has no power. That's all. I mean, I don't know. I'm sure there are other reasons, but I would imagine that would be one.
Also, they're just neoliberal corporate bootlickers, man. I had to sing the same song over and over again.
Well, yeah, I have no doubt about that. I mean, I don't know who on the op-ed, you know, would dictate that thing. But if I was, exclusively a neoliberal corporate bootlicker, I would not endorse Zephyr Teachout. I would endorse Sean Maloney.
Yeah, well, they're still trying to play the game and be like a little bit progressive. Like, it was funny when they were like, oh, you want to fix the subways? Here's all the state Senate candidates you should vote for. And, you know, very notably did not talk about the governor race.
Right. I mean, I don't know.
It's also
funny
they endorsed Jumaane Williams and not Cynthia Nixon, because they're kind of running together.
Yeah. I mean, I guess. I mean, like I say, I think that I don't know. I don't think the Times endorsement is really that important. It's interesting to think about what their mindset is, but I would imagine that's what it is.
Yeah, I don't think it's that important either, but it doesn't reflect well on them.
Yeah, well, the Times is not, you know, like they also, I think, did a very poor job in reconciling the fact they led us into a fake war. I mean, that I would put a higher on the scale of things.
Don't give your money to the Times.
Yes.
Yeah,
I would agree with that.
That's not how
and
you resist
you look
Trump.
At their entire op-ed page is, you know, they're ostensibly it's to give both sides of American politics. But the fact of the matter is that Ross Douthat and Bret Stephens, they have no constituency on the right, as well as having no constituency on the left.
They're like they're for guys who don't really pay attention, but just occasionally check to make sure their right is represented on things like that.
That's exactly right. I mean, Corey Robin has written quite succinctly on this. Like, if you want to actually have to give, you know, those of us who are in our little, you know, coastal bubble elite, our elite coastal bubble or whatever it is that we're in. If you want to give us a real sense of what the debate is between the right and the left in this country, you know, you should be putting guys like Ben Shapiro or Mike Cernovich in your pages.
I think they have expanded the tent quite a bit farther to the right than they have to the left, because they've got folks like Barry Weiss now, who is not just a writer, but an editor there.
Well, I agree. But I think that, like, her whole game is really just sort of, I mean, putting aside the question of Israel, she has no constituency on the right. All she is basically a door opener. You know, if you want to present both sides from the New York Times, Don't just put the door openers on the page, right? Like the greeters.
Yeah, but then
you put the people who are supposed to walk through, like, you know, put Ann Coulter or whatever the version of, or Dana Loesch, like put the lunatics on the page so that people can get a clear notion of what the right consists of. That way it won't be surprising when these things, you know, are revealed that, wow, where'd all these crazy people come from, the Republican Party or in the Trump administration? They came from the Republican Party. That's the conservative movement.
Yeah, but if they were going to represent the debate that's really happening, I think they would have to have, like, racist conspiracy theory nuts who just constantly write lies, which are, you know, which the New York Times probably considers unprintable on one side, and then, like, you know, common sense social Democrats like Bernie on the other, which they also probably won't admit.
I think that they they're at least, let me put it this way, at least when they present a liberal perspective, it is a liberal perspective. When they present a so-called conservative perspective, it is not a conservative perspective. It is what liberals imagine conservatives are still like. and not all liberals. I think many people are more sophisticated about that. But they're putting in a, I don't even want to say a conservative light. They should be putting those race conspirators on there, because that is what is driving the conservative movement in this part and in this country. Like, you know, put in a legit Trump supporter, because these never Trumpers are just biding their time. George Bush gets out there and campaigns for people who are going to just enable Donald Trump. Meanwhile, folks, we're going to take a break and head into the fun half. Last night was Tuesday night, if I'm not mistaken. Check out the Michael Brooks Show. You can see it on all of your podcast platforms and on our YouTube channel. And Jamie and the Antifada.
Yes, yes. So we have a special bonus for patrons this week that dropped Monday. It's the first in a series called History is a Weapon. The first edition is a really great, amusing explanation by Sean of historical materialism. And it's kind of pegged to our boy Francis Fukuyama is back with a new book. He's the guy who said it was the end of history.
I was going
to
say.
In the 90s. Now he's got a book on identity. So it's time to, you know, kick him again. So he maybe people realize that he's not he doesn't have all the answers. Also, we have a new episode dropping either today or tomorrow. I just got the file from Andy in my email, but we have a new episode with Jake Flores, awesome comedian, podcaster. He does a podcast called Pod Damn America, which is amazing. And we talked to him about all kinds of different things, comedy, politics, socialism. Yeah, check it out. Patreon.com/TheAntifada or Stitcher or iTunes. We also have a YouTube page. So, yeah, many ways to listen.
And Matt?
Literary Hangover coming up this weekend. Hopefully, I'm thinking it's going to work out. The Scarlet Letter, we're finally doing that episode. We recently did a history book called The Barbarous Years about Early Settlements in America. And we're going to be doing Corey Robbins' Reactionary Mind coming up soon. So.
Mm. Did an interview with him on that. I guess it might have been 3 or 4 years ago. Was that when that book came out?
I think you might have had two interviews with him on that. Like,
yeah, I've talked to him a couple times. Maybe when the soft cover came out.
You are traveling light years ahead in time.
Yeah, just skipping around a little bit.
All right, folks, don't forget you can become a member, support this program at jointhemajorityreport.com. Quick break, 646-257-3920. If you are a New York State resident, make sure you vote tomorrow. Let's get Cynthia Nixon and Zephyr Teach out, among others, elected. Okay, see you in the fun half.
I give her my love, she says no, 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 no. I give her my heart, she says no, 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 no. 'Cause you're only ask her to walk with me. She shakes her head at me. She's a pretty little doll who says no, 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 no. All the night time through, she says no, no, no. If I ask her to walk with me, why can't she ever say to
no, no.